Hi, everybody. We need your help if you like this podcast. Make sure you subscribe if you're not already getting us every day. And tell your friends. Plus, leave us a rating and review on iTunes. It really helps us in a big way, and it helps other people find us.
In El Paso, Texas, less than 6 miles from the U.S.-Mexico border, sits an Immigration and Customs Enforcement detention center equipped to hold hundreds of undocumented detainees.
The first calls I got were from some men from Cuba who described themselves as Cuban dissidents.
Last month, Associated Press reporter Garance Burke began receiving calls from several men being held inside the facility.
They were really concerned about the treatment that they were getting from the guards. They said that they were not being allowed to get out of the facility on bond, whereas other detainees were. And they said that they had stopped eating and in some cases stopped drinking water.
The self-described Cuban dissidents were not the only detainees refusing food.
The Cuban men told me that there were a group of men from India who were in even worse shape than they, the Cubans, were. They said the Indian men were being force-fed. And I said, force-fed? What does that look like? Typically, medical experts wind a tube around their finger to make it bend and then put some lubricant on the tip and shove it into a patient's nose. And one of the detainees who I spoke with last week, who was himself being force-fed, described it as just excruciating, that he's having persistent nosebleeds. The procedure causes him to vomit. It sounds really, really painful.
The detainee says he lost 50 pounds since the start of his hunger strike.
This man came to the United States seeking asylum. He was escaping a very violent situation in his home state of Punjab in India. He walked across the border, was charged with a misdemeanor that sometimes folks don't even end up serving time in immigration detention for. He ended up instead in the El Paso Processing Center, where he, like the Cubans, said that he was being discriminated against, was not allowed to get out on bond, and he decided to stop eating and drinking in protest of the conditions there.
ICE officials have since confirmed that 10 detainees are on a hunger strike in the El Paso facility, and 9 of them are being force-fed under a court order issued by a federal judge in mid-January. I'm Matt Katz, filling in for Tenzina Vega this week, and this is The Takeaway. When I spoke to Garance Burke, she walked me through the steps that ICE is supposed to take before force-feeding detainees.
Hunger strikes among immigrant detainees are actually pretty uncommon. And what's even more uncommon is for ICE to go to federal judges and ask for a court order to get permission to force-feed those people who are on hunger strike. We as yet have not been able to see copies of those court orders, but the government says that they have permission to do this. That has occurred a few times in the past. We noted other instances in which the government asked a judge for permission to start force-feeding people, but no one we've spoken with has heard of this actually occurring before, which puts us in really uncharted territory for the government to be feeding people against their will.
Has ICE responded to your reporting in any way other than saying that they do have authorization to do this?
The government has said that they don't retaliate in any way against hunger strikers, and for their health and safety, the agency monitors the food and water intake of detainees who are refusing to eat, who are on hunger strike. But from talking to this Indian man last week, who we identified by his last name, Singh, it sounds as if the detainees have a very different version of events, which includes being, you know, dragged from their cells 3 times a day, strapped down on a bed while a whole group of people forces these tubes into their noses.
And in the meantime, these detainees are telling you that their concerns, their issues are not being addressed.
That's correct. They say, you know, they want to be able to get out of detention on bond. The one Indian man who I spoke with said that his asylum claim was unfairly denied. Some of these men have passed the first step towards getting asylum. They're all sort of in different immigration situations, but they do feel that the mistreatment inside the facility continues. And I think that, you know, this is just really unprecedented because I think most people were familiar with the idea of force feeding at Guantanamo Bay, you know, when that situation garnered such international blowback. So I think it was just very surprising for many people to learn that force feeding is actually happening, you know, on the mainland in immigration detention facilities.
Your reporting has gotten some play in Congress. Do you think there's going to be a national response on this issue of force feeding?
Well, late last week, a congresswoman from Texas toured the facility, and she said that it was really extremely concerning to see the situation that the men were in. I don't know as yet what else may come of this, but so far, Congresswoman Veronica Escobar is saying that she's definitely going to follow up.
Where else might this story go from here? What are some of your unanswered questions about what's happening in this El Paso facility that you're pursuing this week?
Well, I think one of the things that we're really interested in is what do these court orders say? What were the reasons given by the U.S. government to force feed these men? I think that the government typically says that it's for their own health, that if they did not do this, the men would die. But on the other hand, you know, you have all of these international bodies that say, even if that's the case, if the men are able to make decisions on their own, then it's unethical to force them to eat. So we'd really like to see a copy of those court orders. We also really want to get a sense as to where else this may be happening. The government has said that there is force feeding occurring in El Paso, but we are wondering if this may be occurring elsewhere or has occurred elsewhere in the recent past inside these immigration detention facilities around the country.
That was Garance Burke, investigative reporter for the AP. We reached out to Immigration and Customs Enforcement about this story. They sent us a comment that included this statement. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement fully respects the rights of all people to voice their opinion without interference. ICE does not retaliate in any way against hunger strikers. ICE explains the negative health effects of not eating to our detainees for their health and safety. ICE closely monitors the food and water intake of those detainees identified as being on a hunger strike. We're going to go now to Grace Meng, a senior U.S. researcher with Human Rights Watch. Her group opposes the practice of force feeding. And last year, she visited immigrant detainees on a hunger strike in Washington State's Northwest Detention Center. Grace, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Grace, is force feeding allowed under international law? Can you explain what the rules are here?
Force feeding, which as Garance described involves pushing a feeding tube down a patient's nose, is inherently cruel, inhuman, and degrading. Medical ethics, human rights norms generally prohibit force feeding of people who are competent, who are rational and able to refuse food and know the consequences of refusing food. And it can rise to the level of torture as defined under the Convention Against Torture.
You mentioned medical ethics. I want to go back to something that AP reporter Garance Burke told me. According to her, force feeding raises a lot of flags for the people tasked with getting detainees to eat.
Nonetheless, this still poses real ethical issues for the doctors and nurses and other medical professionals who work inside these facilities because the American Medical Association, for instance, says force feeding hunger strikers is unethical.
So to Garance's point about the ethical questions that doctors and nurses are faced with, are they violating the Hippocratic Oath to do no harm if they carry this out? What are their obligations here?
Well, in medical ethics, it's allowed, you know, a patient is allowed to refuse treatment. And it's a medical professional's duty to inform the patient of the consequences of refusing treatment. But in the same way that someone who has cancer could decide to refuse chemotherapy, someone who is rational, who is on hunger strike, who is competent, can refuse the treatment of food. Mm-hmm. And I have spoken to, you know, one doctor who said, and for him, it would violate medical ethics to force feed someone.
So when a detainee does go on a hunger strike, if this happens, how should medical officials respond? How should ICE respond, in your opinion?
Well, certainly the duty of medical professionals in these facilities to counsel the people who are on hunger strike to make sure that they understand the consequences, to assess whether they are rational and competent. But I think what's really important is that these hunger strikers are trying to draw attention to really difficult, dangerous, and often abusive conditions. And it's really important for ICE and the doctors to be listening to their concerns, to recognize that there's a valid protest going on. And to say that force feeding is necessary is really just an appalling response to, someone asserting their right to protest.
Garance mentioned that this is the first case we know of involving forced feeding in immigration detention, but it was used in Guantanamo against accused terrorist detainees. And then you also spoke with ICE detainees on a hunger strike in Washington state last year, and they were threatened with force feeding. Is that right?
Yes. The men that I spoke to said that they had been threatened with force feeding. They were shown a copy of a court order saying that they were going to be force fed. And because of this threat, they began taking liquid nutrition. But they continued to refuse solid food for some time afterward.
How effective of threatening the force feeding do you think is that in this detention, in a detention facility? I mean, is ICE doing the right thing by threatening it? And then, you know, maybe the detainees will start to take some food.
From a medical ethics perspective, I don't think threatening someone, a patient, with restraint, with force, with coercion, in order to make them consent to treatment would be appropriate. And I think what was really being lost in the focus simply on the force feeding is the conditions, is the situation of people who are protesting what is essentially indefinite detention. You know, one thing about immigration detention is that you're held until your case concludes. It's in ICE's interest to make you give up, to make you say that, you know, you will just stop and be deported. Anyone who persists in trying to pursue their case because of policies of this administration are going to find it harder and harder to get released while their cases are pending. And so, you know, these people are making an act of desperation in response to a really irrational situation.
Grace, can you tell me real quick before I leave you, what would you like to see from Congress in response to the force feeding that ICE confirms is going on?
Well, as I was saying, I think that the force feeding is a serious problem and it needs to be stopped. But Congress has to do its job in terms of oversight of these detention centers. You know, the Office of Inspector General recently put out a report saying that there were 14,000 deficiencies in ICE's own detention standards between October 2015 and June 2018. ICE only issued 2 fines during this time. This is an incredibly broken system. Congress should do its job and make sure that conditions are safe, and they should reduce the amount of money that is going to detaining people in this abusive system.
Thank you, Grace. Grace Meng is a senior U.S. researcher with Human Rights Watch. Thanks for coming on to The Takeaway.
Thank you very much.
Bueno, muchas gracias a todos. Desde hace 2 horas teníamos resultados que marcaban una clara tendencia, incluso tuvimos la tentación de salir hace 2 horas a dar nuestros resultados.
Voters in El Salvador elected a new president on Sunday. 37-year-old Nayib Bukele, the former mayor of the country's capital city, San Salvador, won the election in a landslide. Heather Geis is here. She's a freelance reporter in San Salvador. She's been covering the recent elections for Al Jazeera. Hi there, Heather.
Hi, Matt.
Let's start with a quick overview on Nayib Bukele. Who is he and what's his relationship with the leading political party, FMLN?
Nayib Bukele is most well known as the former mayor of San Salvador, the capital city. Before that, he was a mayor of a suburb outside the capital. He was mayor in the capital city from 2015 to 2018. And for both those terms as mayor, he was part of the governing left-wing party, the FMLN. FMLN ejected him from the party in 2017, and that was because he was breaking ranks within the party. We can kind of see this trajectory of him building himself up as his own persona, his own brand, basically since he became a mayor in his first term. And so that, combined with some instances of defamation against party stalwarts, particularly one incident that was interpreted as a sexist, kind of misogynist incident. He threw an apple at a woman lawmaker and called her a witch. After that, he was ejected from the FMLN. And to run for president, he didn't have time to kind of consolidate his own party. So he went on to run with this right-wing party called GANA, which is a breakoff from the other main dominant traditional party, ARENA. So we're kind of seeing him shift pretty quickly from the left-wing party to a right-wing party.
And he seems to have galvanized younger voters by engaging them on social media. Was that evident in the voter turnout on Sunday?
So voter turnout on Sunday was down. It's been declining since 2004, and this time was no exception. Voter turnout was about 45%, and that's compared to 55% in the last presidential election in 2014. So I think the kind of popular disenchantment and frustration with the political class is really evident, not only in voting for this candidate that's not representing two of the dominant parties, but also the fact that people just aren't bothering to go to the polls. Mm-hmm. That said, he has really spoken to younger voters in particular. His kind of anti-establishment message, I think, really resonates with them. Also, he is cool. He wears jeans and a leather jacket and a backwards hat. And as you said, he's really used social media to his benefit. He launched his platform in a Facebook Live video, which actually he was criticized for because it was pre-recorded. but he's speaking to a different generation. And I think that, you know, we also have to remember that this is a generation of voters that has come of age after the signing of the peace accords that ended the Civil War in 1992. And the two parties that have controlled the executive for the last 30 years, 20 years with the right-wing ARENA party and 10 years with the FMLN, both those parties have their roots in the Civil War in very clear ideological camps. And so someone who is kind of bucking with that tradition is well received among a younger audience that doesn't have those memories of the war. And especially in a country where there hasn't been a process of constructing a historical memory, bringing those Civil War era crimes to justice, to be able to have that collective memory.
Heather, let's take a step back from the recent presidential elections for a moment. According to the International Displacement Monitoring Center, the rate of people fleeing their homes in El Salvador is the second highest in the world. Why are people leaving their homes at such alarming rates?
The forced displacement crisis is really a huge issue, and we think a lot about people leaving the country, but a lot of people often move four or five times within the country before they make that decision to leave. So it's kind of like an invisible internal forced displacement crisis that's happening behind all that. A lot of this is really attributed to the gangs in the country, and the internal forced displacement crisis hasn't adequately been recognized by the government. So we're also talking about a lack of attention for victims that allows this to just kind of perpetuate. When we're talking about people leaving the country, there's also a lot of folks that are going because of economic reasons. But these two issues are also really closely linked, especially when we think about extortion being part of the scenario as well, which affects a majority of small businesses.
Sure. And then it becomes an international issue because migrants from El Salvador are streaming north to the United States, which we know is drawing the ire of President Trump, who has threatened to cut aid to the country. What does the new president's election mean possibly for the U.S. relationship with El Salvador?
So that relationship has been becoming more tense. As you mentioned, Trump has threatened to cut off aid to El Salvador and its neighbors for failing to stem migration. In some ways, we might expect Bukele's government to be a bit more friendly with the United States on some issues. For example, the current Salvadoran government has been supportive of Venezuela, whereas Bukele has spoken out against Maduro. Also on an economic front, the current government, even if it hasn't played out in practice, but kind of has more of a socialist kind of economic discourse, whereas Bukele is quite business friendly. He comes from a wealthy business family himself.
El Salvador makes up a third of the Northern Triangle, and that also includes Guatemala and Honduras. The presence of Guatemala and Honduras are very politically right-wing, and they've been involved in some high-profile corruption scandals. Do we have an idea of how Bukele's relationship with the Guatemalan and Honduran presidents, how that's going to shake out?
His popularity looks a little bit similar in some ways, I think, to Guatemalan President Jimmy Morales. Jimmy Morales arrived on the scene when he was campaigning, saying, you know, not corrupt, not a thief, I'm not going to rob from you. And his campaign slogans didn't age very well once he came under investigation for some corruption. And Bukele, again, has also campaigned as, you know, an alternative to the two dominant political parties. But at the same time, he doesn't have a completely clean track record either. He's accused and investigated for some irregular contracting while he was mayor. He's also investigation for tax evasion. So we'll see how his anti-corruption mission goes forward.
And before I leave you, I want to go back through history a little bit to understand just how El Salvador got to this point. Obviously, El Salvador went through a brutal civil war in which the U.S. was actively involved. That ended in 1992. Can you describe if there are any political remnants of that war that continue to be felt today? If we look at his presidency through the prism of that war, how should we view that?
Yeah, so when he claimed victory, he said El Salvador has turned a page on this post-war era, kind of saying it's like it's a new political cycle. One thing for El Salvador, you know, people talk about the peace accords, but El Salvador has never really achieved peace. The recommendations of the peace accords weren't really implemented. Nobody has been held accountable for the abuses that took place during the war. 75,000 people were killed, mostly at the hands of the military and allied death squads, and nobody has been brought to justice because shortly after the signing of the peace accords, an amnesty law was implemented that didn't allow for any prosecution. And so I think that a country that has just been so devastated by violence, both during the civil war and then afterwards, once the gang problem really kicked up, it's hard to imagine peace without justice.
Heather Geese is a freelance reporter in San Salvador, El Salvador. Thank you so much for joining us on The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, Takeaway listeners. Amy Walter here, host of Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway. Every week, I'll take you beyond the headlines for a deeper understanding of how Washington works, who's pulling the levers of power, and how it all impacts you. I hope you'll check it out. Just search for Politics with Amy Walter in your podcast app and subscribe. Happy listening.
This is Matt Katz. I'm filling in for Tanzina this week here on The Takeaway. Last year, 8 journalists were killed in war-torn Yemen. Since the outbreak of civil war in 2015, few Western journalists have been able to report consistently from within the country.
Because it's such a difficult conflict to get access to, this is not a conflict that is easy to report on.
That challenge of access to a country facing famine, cholera, and bloodshed has led some to call it the forgotten war. Nema El-Bagher just returned from 11 days inside Yemen. She's a CNN senior international correspondent, and her reporting is focused on the arms trail that the U.S. is leaving behind in the country.
So we wanted to see, if we get there on the ground, how easy is it to find this weaponry? And the answer is actually pretty easy.
I spoke with Nema about her reporting from her war zone, where bad actors are getting access to American arms.
The situation is still very unstable. The ceasefire is not holding. That was our experience at the front lines, that just on any random day, actually there was incoming fire, incoming mortars from the Houthi positions, but also dangerous because you have this miasma, this swamp of uneasy alliances. So even on the side of the coalition, you are not necessarily in the best of hands when you're traveling in territory that's under the control of the coalition forces.
Sure. And now you said you found American-made weapons pretty much everywhere. What kind of weapons are we talking about, and which groups seem to be using them?
All of the groups under the aegis of the coalition that were fighting against the Houthi militias seem to have been given pretty a pretty standard set of kit, and that was anything from high-tech American assault rifles all the way up to MRAPs, to mine-resistant armored vehicles. And the reason that's very troubling is because the MRAP is essentially the building block of how the U.S. prosecutes its wars. And because of that, it's considered to be very sensitive military technology, because if you, in theory, if you get your hands on an MRAP and you figure out the vulnerabilities of the MRAP, if you're in the business of trying to put together an IED, an improvised explosive device, to exploit the vulnerabilities of the MRAP, it wouldn't be that hard to reverse engineer once you got your hands on an MRAP.
So how are these Iranian-backed Houthi rebels getting the MRAPs?
Most of those that we found, we were told, had been captured in conflict. And we were able to track the serial numbers of the MRAPs that the Houthi militias had paraded as booty of war, and track it directly back to a U.S. arms sale to the United Arab Emirates, and directly back to one of the largest U.S. manufacturers, one of the largest suppliers to the U.S. military. So this is quite a big deal for the U.S., for us to have found out that these MRAPs were ending up not just in the hands of Iranian-backed militias, but we spoke to sources who told us that Iranian intelligence had been granted access by the Houthis to the MRAPs. And that has to be very, very worrying for the United States.
Wow. Now, how does this jive with the arms sales agreement that the U.S. has with Saudi Arabia if this important military material is ending up in Iranian hands?
When you sign an arms sales agreement with a country, there is something called the end user agreement. So you, as the buying party, certify that you are the end user of this equipment. And in order to transfer that to another party, you have to receive from the Department of Defense what is called a transfer certificate. And we asked the Department of Defense, did you grant them a transfer certificate? And they said no. And they actually went further. And they said, not only did we not grant them a transfer certificate, but we have not authorized the transfer to any parties in Yemen.
And that would seem to be raise some concerns in the Pentagon, I'm sure. This might be a good time for you to help clarify a little bit about what we know about the sides of this conflict. I mean, you have the Saudis and the UAE-led coalition, which is funded in part by the U.S., and they're fighting against Houthi rebels supported by Iran. And then there's al-Qaeda that's in the mix here. Can you explain some of this to us?
Well, and I think that's really what, from a distance, hasn't been properly explained, I think, not just to the U.S. public, but to many of the actors, even in government, that when we got there on the ground, what we found was an al-Qaeda-linked militia. The founder of this militia, it's called the Abu al-Abbas militia, is actually on both the U.S., the Saudi, and the UAE terror list. And yet his militia has been folded into the Yemeni forces, the 35th Brigade. And because of that, is a recipient of coalition resources, which of course include U.S. MRAPs. So you have this appalling alliance, which means that U.S. weaponry is ending up in the hands of not just an al-Qaeda funder, but also an al-Qaeda trainer. When you look at the breakdown of why he is on the terror list in the United States, part of that is because the role that he has played as a trainer for al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, AQAP, in Yemen. And yet this is someone whose soldiers are now parading in American Oshkoshes, in American MRAPs. The Department of Defense told us that they had no idea that this was happening and that they would now be launching an investigation based on the findings that we had presented to them. But this has all been hiding in plain sight.
What kind of an effect is this weaponry having on the war, this American weaponry that seems to be ending up on all sides? What does it mean on the ground?
It means that it's very, very hard to force the parties to abide by any ceasefire agreement. It means that it's going to be very, very hard to pick up the pieces, because what we have seen in these conflicts around the world is that when you have this influx of weaponry, especially weaponry that is of the kind of quality as the kind of U.S. weaponry that's flooding this conflict, it's very, very difficult to close Pandora's box and get people to abide by any kind of agreements. And we've seen that in Yemen, to the extent that even now, weeks after the ceasefire agreements were signed, because that hasn't actually translated into an actual ceasefire on the ground, people are starving. And there has to be responsibility taken for that. Because what does it mean for Yemen in 3 years?
Right.
When, you know, when the coalition has withdrawn, or when the world decides, oh, well, we have forced a peace agreement and now we can kind of wash our hands of this. I mean, when we arrived, the heartbreaking thing is that people really felt that the world had forgotten them. And that can only be reinforced and inflamed by this feeling that, well, it's American weaponry and it's an American ally that is prosecuting this war. So why do we as Yemenis matter?
Nema, thank you so much. Thanks for bringing out us a story, and be safe if and when you return to Yemen.
Thank you so much for giving this the platform.
Nema El-Bagher is CNN Senior International Correspondent. Anyone can access any federal court documents in the United States for a cost. 10 cents a page is the going rate. And that might seem cheap, but it's more than what it costs the government to send out those documents, a lot more. Some estimates put the price at just half of 1/10,000th of a penny to send out a page. And for reporters or academics who are combing through thousands of pages of information, 10 cents can quickly add up. Now, a group of legal nonprofit groups are asking the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals to weigh in on these federal court document fees. For more, I'm joined now by Shira Shenlin, a former United States District Judge and counsel at Strook, Strook & Levin. Welcome, Shira.
Hi there.
And we're also joined by Matt Ford, a staff writer for The New Republic, who recently reported on this case. Matt, we'll go to you first. The case deals with the public access to court electronic records, or PACER. I never actually knew what that acronym stood for. There you go. So PACER is a system for accessing federal court documents. Matt, what is PACER and how long has it been around?
Well, it's a web portal that allows anybody in the United States to access virtually any court document at their fingertips, both currently working their way through the system, as well as cases from recent decades. And it's kind of an amazing innovation because before the advent of the internet, the only way to view these documents would have been to go to a courthouse in person and sit in the clerk's office and thumb through them. So in the 1990s, they developed a system that would allow people to use the fledgling internet to view them instead.
And every time you click on a link that takes you to a page, it's 10 cents. Why is it 10 cents?
Well, it's a fee that they impose, and they argue that allows them to maintain the system and provide public access to these documents. And to the extent that that was true in the 1990s, it does not appear to be true now. The cost of storing these files and disseminating them has dropped precipitously thanks to the advent of new technologies. And as you mentioned, the cost of actually distributing these on the government side, you know, 1/1,000th of a penny is marginal compared to the amount of money they bring in for each click.
And what is the federal government doing with all this money they're making off of PACER?
Well, the judiciary is using it as almost sort of a slush fund of sorts, as one author put it. They're using it to fund a variety of improvements in courthouses. Now, that may sound good, you know, things like, access for jurors, automated bankruptcy notices, even a court study down in Mississippi. But these aren't really what the PACER fees are meant to be used for. Federal law actually gives a much clearer direction for that. And these are the sort of things that should be paid for by congressional appropriations.
Judge Shenlin, you signed on to an amicus brief saying that court documents should be obtained for free. Why do you object to the federal government charging this 10 cents a page fee here?
Well, because we believe in public access to courtrooms and for people to walk into a courtroom. There's no charge, obviously. You can sit in the back and watch anything you want. But much of what goes on in court is not in the courtroom. It's in the papers that are filed in the docket. And so if you really want a picture of a case, if you want to know what was the complaint and what was the response to the complaint and what was the discovery, you need to get into the docket. So to really have public access, the public has to have an equal opportunity to obtain those papers, not just those who can afford it, but everyone. Very few cases, as you might know, actually go to trial. So much of what happens in the federal court is not in the room, not in that actual courtroom. Only about 2% of cases go to trial. So most of the work is outside that courtroom. And if you need to get that that picture, you need to get into the papers. So the best example is what we call pro se litigants, which are the poor people who cannot afford counsel. And they write their own petitions and they try to get their claims passed by the court. But if they had access to other people's papers that have been successful, they would write better papers. Mm-hmm. And they just don't have that access. It's too expensive for poor people to do it page by page.
And that's who would be most affected by, who are most affected by these fees. It's people who cannot afford to spend a ton of money to pull these documents because they're not even paying for their own attorney.
Well, yes, that's true. But in my opinion, there are three groups that are most affected. The first are what I call these pro se litigants, which means I am for myself. There's no counsel. But the other group are academics and researchers who want to work with big data, who want aggregated data of thousands of cases across the country. And academics are not the richest people in the world, and their universities can't always fund them. So they need to get data from all over the country, and they're not getting that data. And the third group, I think, are journalists. I know we have a journalist on the phone, but some journalists are better funded than others. We have local community journalists. Media is all types of different entities these days. And so if you want to do a story, you need to get a lot of data for it. You may not have funds to do this at 10 cents a page, and that 10 cents is completely unnecessary.
Matt, as reporters, this has an impact for those of us in this line of work, right? I mean, I've slogged through the Pacer system many times and clicked 10 cents, 10 cents, 10 cents. It's sort of a clunky system. How are journalists affected by these fees?
Well, it really comes into play when you deal with stories that require you to go through a lot of cases. And, you know, for academics and researchers, as the judge mentioned, are the biggest impact hit by that. And as the judge said, you know, if you work for the New York Times or Politico, it's not that big of a deal to pay, you know, a certain amount of fees for these documents. But if you're a smaller news outlet, if you're working at a local paper, and if you're working as an independent journalist, then these can be formidable barriers.
Can you lay out why other Americans should care that it might cost an independent journalist a bunch of money to dig into a court case, a scenario where that might matter to the average American?
Well, you know, the scrutiny of the courts is one of the most important aspects of legal journalism. You know, it's a way to check and make sure that judges are actually, you know, following through on case law, following through on precedent. And not only that, but they're making decisions that are in the public's best interest.
And Judge, are there options for people who don't want to go online to pay for these documents? I mean, could you show up in the courthouse and request documents for free, or is that not even possible?
You could still go to the courthouse and request documents, but it's not for free, because if you want to read them and sit there and take notes, that's free. But if you want to make a photocopy, you're back to the 10 cents a page.
And Matt, when can we expect a decision in this lawsuit? Do you have a sense of the time frame here?
Well, within the coming year, we would see the oral arguments in this case before the Federal Circuit, and a decision could come, you know, later this year or early next year.
Matt Ford is a staff writer at The New Republic, and Shira Shenlin is a former United States District Judge. Thank you very much to you both.
You're most welcome. Bye-bye.
And that's your takeaway today. You can always call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. My Twitter is at MattKatz00. You can hit me up there. I'm just your good old ham and egg reporter. Thanks so much for being with us today, and happy Chinese New Year to everyone celebrating. I'm Matt Katz, filling in for Tanzina, and this is The Takeaway.